This hour of the Jeff Horvitz Show brought to you by Nemarco's Pizza with three locations in Flagstaff.
This is the Jeff Horvitz Show.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Horvitz Show. I'm your host, Mark Howitt, on this beautiful Friday afternoon. Got a very special show for you. In the studio with me is Magda from Poland, originally, and Tom from the UK. And these guys are couch surfers. We're going to talk a little bit about what is couch surfing. Magda, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Magda, you are from, you're born in Poland.
Yes.
But your English is very good, and you actually came along with a British accent, I guess, from being with Tom. And Tom, you're from England?
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, we always think of the whole thing as England, but it's actually the United Kingdom of England.
Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And Great Britain's made up of England, Scotland, and Wales.
And the whole thing is like the half the size of Arizona with 10 times the amount of people. We have about 7 million people here in Arizona. You guys have something like close to 70 million between the whole...
Yeah, about 66, 67 million, something like that.
Wow. So if we were in the UK, instead of three of us in the room right now, there'd be like 30 of us. It's that much more crowded. It's incomprehensible. Of course, most of those people are going to be in London. And
yeah, so London's got a population of 10 million.
Yeah, it's a big city. Okay, a lot bigger than Phoenix. Okay, so you guys are couch surfers, and you're actually staying on my couch, although technically not on my couch. We've got a guest room. But tell me, what is couch surfing, and how did you get involved with this thing?
Well, it started with me, so I introduced Tom to couch surfing. And for me, it started over 10 years ago when I was planning my first travel abroad, initially with my friends, who then decided she can't go. So I was left alone, and I was initially just looking to save some money, reading things online, and I found about couchsurfing, sent a few requests. I was invited to stay with someone in Barcelona, and it started this kind of adventure. So after that, I used it for 3 or 4 years. Then I had a little break, and then I introduced Tom to it as well. And we are couchsurfing together.
So what was your very first couch? Was it in Barcelona?
Yeah, it was in Barcelona, and I mean, it was kind of a life-changing experience, because before I was always really... I was scared to go abroad on my own. I went regardless.
Right.
But the person who I met, my first host, became my friend for a couple of years. We stayed in touch. We visited each other. And he told me, if you want to travel, you just have to do it. Don't look for company. Don't wait for other people to do it. Just go. And he literally was kind of pushing me, just buy that ticket, buy that ticket. So I got my ticket to Mexico. And I went to Mexico for a month on my own. Without speaking Spanish, and with all my friends and family doing, like pulling their hair, saying, you'll die, they'll kill you there, don't do it.
How old were you at the time?
26.
So you're mid-20s.
25, 26, okay. Yeah.
Post-university?
Yeah, yeah. Probably.
Wow. And did you learn Spanish while you were there?
No, I started learning when I came back, properly. Realizing it would have been easier.
Nice. And... Yeah. Tom, you was your first couch surfing with Magda?
Yes, yeah. So not so long ago, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys, how did you two meet?
We met through work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we were both working for a company in Oxford, doing archaeology, basically.
So you're basically both archaeologists.
Yeah, and we met on site.
In Turkey? Is that what you're talking about?
In Oxford.
Oh, you met on site in Oxford.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So we were working for a company called Oxford Archaeology, basically,
and
we were both working on site in Oxford.
But you also, you did archaeology in Turkey, I think is what you told me.
Yeah, so that was during, in between years at university and after university. So that's a different style of archaeology to what I was doing professionally.
Oh, okay.
So it's a research archaeology rather than commercial archaeology.
What's commercial archaeology?
So in the UK... part of the planning process incorporates archaeological survey, and that can take any form from a desk-based assessment, which is where you assess maps and written records to see what the likelihood of anything surviving in that area is, all the way through various stages of excavation to opening up a large area and sending a team into to dig what's there, basically.
Okay.
And it has to occur to prevent the destruction of valuable heritage, basically.
So I always think I've done a little bit of archaeology, mostly field archaeology, actually out there digging, mm-hmm. which is the part I like.
Yeah,
finding stuff in the dirt that's really, really old. I've dug in Israel, and
And you've dug in Turkey, which is similar ages. It's stuff that's really, really old.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different style of archaeology as well. You get much more monumental archaeology, as we describe it. The site I was working on was a Middle Byzantine site. So roughly sort of like 1,200 years old, you know, so give or take to maybe 1,000 years old. But the site itself went back further than that into the Roman period, though not a lot of that period was left, essentially.
And the Hittites were up there too, weren't they, into
Eastern
Turkey? Yeah,
in that region, yeah.
Okay, so back to the couch surfing thing. So Magda introduced you to couch surfing.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first experience?
My first experience was in Uruguay.
Uruguay, okay.
With a gentleman called Fernando. And we were in the middle of our sort of big tour that we're just coming to the end of now. And we knew we wanted to go through Uruguay while we were down in South America, but we didn't want to work our way up the coast like most tourists do. We wanted to go through the internal part of Uruguay. So Magda sent out requests for people who were like couch surfing hosts in the internal areas. And one fella turned around and said, yeah, you can stay with me for a couple of days. So we ended up in a sleepy town called Sarandi del Shi, which turns out is very, very small, and not even Uruguayans go there. No one visits it. And it was like really pleasant, you know. So we stayed on a spare mattress of his and shared meals together, and he lent us his bikes. We went for rides in the countryside and that sort of thing.
Okay, so you guys left the UK when for this trip?
October
22.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you've been a year and a half couch surfing the whole time, or a lot of it?
No. We tried a little bit in South America, but it doesn't seem to be that popular.
Okay.
And we don't really want to send like 20 requests or anything like that. We'd rather read and have the selected little group. If someone is available to host us, that's great. If not, we just stay in a hostel.
Okay. Hostel or... Did you camp along the way too?
No, we don't have our own tents, so we couldn't.
So it's hostel and couch surfing.
Yeah.
So you've met a lot of people then through couch surfing in this year and a half that you've been traveling, I'm guessing.
We had the best experience in Uruguay when we went for one of the meetings because the community is still very lively out there. So they organize weekly meetings, language exchanges and things like that. And we joined one of the meetings. And it just turned out to be fantastic. People were so welcoming. They invited us to their traditional meal, which is they eat gnocchi on every 29th of the month.
Like the Spanish potato pasta?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. They make them at home. And yeah, one of the girls just invited us to stay with them for the dinner. She made all the gnocchi. We got some wine. We went for a parade as well.
Wow.
A pride parade with them. It was like very different and interesting experience, but they were fantastic people.
So
we haven't had that anywhere else, unfortunately.
When you left the UK, did you fly into Uruguay, or where did you end up? What was the start of your journey?
Well, we initially flew to Malta to get married, and we were there for just over a week, and then we went to Greece for our sort of official honeymoon, as it were. Then we had about a day and a half, 2 days in the UK to wash clothes and swap bags, and then we flew out to Mexico.
Okay.
It's been a quite a roundabout trip. So we started in Yucatan, then went to Jamaica, Dominican Republic, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, back into Peru, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, back into Argentina, Chile, then back up to Bogota, flew to Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, quickly skipped through Belize, back into Mexico, and then worked our way through Mexico up to here.
So is your Spanish good now, or is it still?
Well, mine was non-existent when we started, so it's definitely better than it was.
It's at least 100% better.
Well, I'm probably on like upper intermediate level, so in most of the places, I have no problem. In Chile, it's difficult because they have very specific accent.
Yes, I've noticed that about people from all parts of Latin America and South America. The accents are very different, and even the words they use.
Yes, that's true. So that's the biggest challenge. But when we started this trip, I could already speak quite well. So
nice. So Polish, English, and Spanish.
Yeah.
Anything else?
learning Russian.
Learning
still,
Russian.
Still very
just
basic.
In case.
Just in case, yes. You never know.
You never know, because the Poles, I mean, you guys have been stuck between the Russians and the Germans, and every war seems to go through Poland. We've talked about this before. Yeah. Whether it be Napoleon, fighting the Russians back to, up to Hitler, fighting the Russians, and now Ukraine is right on your doorstep.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
And you, I don't know if you've been back to Poland recently or...
Yeah, since the war started, I've been several times.
Okay.
And I think about 4 million Ukrainian people moved.
That's what
to
I was
going to
ask.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's a lot of Ukrainians, 4 million. Wow.
I think about that was the estimate. And obviously, most of them were trying to stay on the east. But then people from the west were really happy to help. So, for example, my best friend's fiancé had an empty flat and they just let some Ukrainian family to stay there. And that was quite common occurrence that people were inviting Ukrainians to like or families or especially single mothers to stay in their spare rooms or...
Oh, well, like their husbands that. Are probably fighting.
Yeah.
And that still must be going on.
As far as I'm aware, yes.
Wow.
They still fight.
So give me a quick Polish perspective on this. Are the Poles really afraid of the situation in Ukraine? What's the Polish take on...
When it started, I think we all were really terrified because no one knew what was going to happen. It was so easy to imagine that Russia will just go through Ukraine and we didn't know if they will stop.
At the Polish border.
Or they want to continue. So when it did start, I remember talking to all the Poles around me, all my friends and so on. That was number one topic and we're all absolutely terrified. And I remember Tom's older sister even telling me, if anything bad happens, we have spare room, you can bring your family. So that was the feeling across Europe. And yeah, but as with every war, there are other things that are coming in and the news will take whatever is more urgent,
sensational,
newer, more exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now no one talks about it so much, but the war is still going on.
Interesting. So that's been a big debate in the U.S. is should we send more funding to Ukraine to fight the war? What's your feeling on that? Should the U.S. keep sending military aid?
I don't really know. Obviously, big part of me would like Ukraine just to win, rid them off, and that's it. But it's war. And
it's 3 years now.
Yeah. And people are dying. People are being killed. So I don't know if fueling from any side is good from this kind of like humanistic perspective.
Right.
Helping war is never good, but of course I want Ukraine to win.
So
it's very natural.
To do that, they need to fight, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
And Tom, have you been to Poland?
Quite a few times, yeah.
Okay. You have any perspective on this whole Ukraine thing as a person from the UK?
Beyond war is bad.
right.
I haven't really kept up to date with proceedings, but I think I agree with Magda really that, it's like Putin just needs to be stopped. But, it's like violence is not a recourse that I enjoy. So like,
yeah,
seeing take place. But
war is never, people get hurt, people get killed, maimed for life, houses get destroyed. It's a bad thing.
And countries suffer. But people suffer, countries suffer. And I think there's going to be so much to fix even once it's over,
right?
But the quickest way to resolution, I'm not sure of, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and we know that Putin's pretty popular in Russia because he just got reelected with like 87% of the vote, obviously in a nice fair election. Yeah, that's wow. I obviously rigged. I mean, Russia went to internet voting this last time, which I'm like, wow, they can really probably fix that pretty easy.
Yeah, a bit cheaper.
And cheaper.
Less hands needed.
You're right. It's much easier to cheat. Want to also ask you, so Kausha, first of all, when is the end of your journey? What's your plan? Or do you have a plan to go back, or is this open-ended?
Yeah, so we fly back to the UK on 14th of May.
Okay, so it'll be... A solid over a year and a half out, and then back to work.
Not straight away. No, we've got a friend's wedding in Poland, so we'll be going over there for a few weeks to catch up with Magda's friends and family over there.
Okay.
And we'll start looking for work when we get back, basically.
So trains all through Europe? You go train the UK to Poland, or do you actually fly?
We fly.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I was in the UK and... gosh, when was that? 2000? No, it wasn't even 2000. 94, because the channel had just opened.
Oh, right. Wow. Haven't heard that term for a while.
Yeah, what do they have a different term for it now?
Most people just call it like the Eurostar,
okay,
like the name of the train, basically.
Yeah, because they had just opened it for trains, and then can you drive through it now?
You can take trains on the cars on the train.
Put your car on the train and then go through that way. Okay. Yeah, it had just opened up, and it was the channel, is what they were calling it back then.
It didn't catch on.
It didn't stick. Except with me, I guess. And that's it's a underground tunnel that goes all the way into the English Channel, and it pops up in, is it in Brussels or in France? Or
Paris.
It pops up in, in France.
It pops up in France, yeah.
Okay. So you no longer have to swim the English Channel, you can just take
it. No, it's much easier.
Much easier now. Want to ask you about what was your best couch surfing experience and your worst couch surfing experience?
I think I'd have to hand over to Magda. My experiences are not as extensive as hers.
I think it would be really hard to pick the best because they were good for various reasons. Hmm. Sometimes you just randomly find a friend. Like, I think Fernanda, who Tom met in Mexico, could be probably one of my best because she was my second couchsurfing experience. It was in Mexico City in 2012. And I spent my birthday with her, her mom, her friends. And she was also interested in archaeology. So she showed me places I would normally not find because they're not so popular.
Okay.
And it just clicked. We just felt like friends. We haven't stayed in touch over this entire period. But when I messaged her a few weeks ago saying, are we in Mexico City with my husband, with my new husband?
Right.
Do you want to meet? She was straight away on it.
So a dozen years passed and you got to meet again.
Exactly. So I think that shows that it was probably the best experience overall for that simple reason that years later we met and we still just started chatting like time didn't pass. It was like, okay, so what's your life now? What do you do? And so on. And yeah, she gave us a few little good tips to where to go in Mexico City.
Wow.
And so on.
That is a pretty neat connection. A total stranger originally.
Yes, exactly.
Now a good friend.
Yeah. I couldn't say we're close friends because it's obviously a massive distance and time gap. But to be able to meet after that many years and still enjoy each other's company, I think she'll be the winner.
And so have you had any really bad couch experience, like bed bugs, bad host?
Not bed bugs, but one of my experiences was a little bit creepy.
Ah.
I was in Peru, and that was my last experience for a couple of years. One of the last experiences for a couple of years because I was kind of fed up and scared. So that was when I traveled in Peru on my own in 2013. And I was invited to stay in a family home, a family that made pisco, so the traditional Peruvian high-volume alcohol.
Oh, okay.
And the man who was the host, I think first of all, he lied about his age. So he's supposed to be around my age.
Okay.
He looked much older. So seeing the face, I thought that was the father, but that was actually my host.
Okay.
So kind of when you're single, when you're like female traveling, you know, it's a bit like, that's suspicious.
Right, right.
But I was offering my own room. The room was covered with thank you cards from other couch surfers and so on. So I was like, maybe I'm overly sensitive. And then he asked me if I wanted to try pisco that his family makes and started just offering me alcohol. But he himself wasn't drinking the same thing, which made me really suspicious.
Ah.
So once he left the room, I smelled his glass and he was drinking water.
Oh,
and that
trying
made
to get you
me
drunk. Yeah.
Really, really scared, like properly scared.
Yeah.
So obviously I just went to bed as soon as I could saying, I'm really sorry. I'm really tired. I really have to go and rest. And next day I was packed by 5 a.m, just trying to leave. And he was waiting outside the room so early. So nothing happened, but that made me really worried.
Yeah.
Just kind of.
It's an unpleasant situation.
Yeah.
That's probably a pretty unusual situation you ran into on couchsurfing because I think most people are very up and up. And
I think so. I didn't have any proper horror stories. You hear about them, but I think they just kind of go around because they're so bad.
Yeah.
That people will share them and then pass them to others as warning. But
and couch surfing, you get to review your host and review your guests.
Yes, yeah.
And so you can kind of check and see if they got a bunch of good, and hopefully they're not fake reviews.
Yeah, I don't think it's that easy to fake a review.
Hopefully not. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Magda and Tom, and I want to touch on Brexit and your thoughts about that. Be right back. You're listening to The Jeff Horvitz Show, and I am Mark Howitz, your host.
Hey, if you're listening to the podcast, please give us a great review and also give us a comment in there. If you're not listening to the podcast, subscribe. Look up The Jeff Horvitz Show. Also on video, Rumble, follow us there. And on YouTube, subscribe. We appreciate everyone who's done that.
You're listening to The Jeff Horvitz Show.
You've heard me talking with Glenn Least of WT Wealth Management over the years, and I enjoy having him on the program because he's a wealth of information and knowledge, and plus he's, you know, a straight talker, easy to talk to when it comes to my portfolio, finances, what's going on in the economy. You want to have a one-on-one conversation with Glenn Least of WT Wealth Management, go ahead and call him right now. It's no obligation, doesn't cost anything. You can get a second set of eyes on your portfolio. Here's his number, Glenn Least at WT Wealth Management, 928-225-2474, 928-225-2474, or send him an email, gleast, that's G-L-E-E-S-T, gleast at WTWealthManagement.com. Last year, Angela and I called the Blind Brothers to get all new blinds in our home in Flagstaff. And man, did they do a great job. They came in, laid out all the options. We've picked a great set of blinds. Then they came back. They took out the old ones, did the installation. I highly recommend having the Blind Brothers do your installation. Mention the Jeff Horvitz Show. Get up to half off the installation. That's in addition to any other advertised specials. Do your neighbors a favor. Call the Blind Brothers, a great Northern Arizona company, at 928-634-2423. 928-634-2423. Or go to theblindbrothers.com.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Horvitz Show. I'm your host, Mark Howitt, and in the studio with me is Tom from the UK and his wife, Magda, from Poland, who are couch surfing with me at my house right now, and fantastic guests. I'm glad to have them here. We all have an interest in archaeology and a number of other things, but I wanted to talk a little bit with Tom real quick about Brexit. And in the U.S., we're not all that. We heard about it, and it you know, was a blurb in the news for a while, and then it kind of just went by the wayside, but I believe it's complete now, right? Is
it officially? Yeah, it's everything went through end of January 2021 was the final to like end of any sort of transition period.
Okay, and for those who don't know, Brexit was the UK decided to leave the EU, the European Union, and I believe it was a public vote.
Yes, it was.
It wasn't just Parliament, but it was actually...
No, yeah, it went out to referendum. And I think from my point of view, because I voted to stay in, I always felt something as important as this should have been expected to get what we call a supermajority. So,
like 60 or 65%?
Exactly. Because in the end, as it turned out, the result was a 52-48 split.
So pretty close.
Exactly.
By leaving the EU, you never... Did the Brits ever adopt the currency?
No.
The euro?
No,
you always had the pound.
The euro.
Yeah. Okay. And so you still have the pound.
Mm-hmm.
Is it done better or worse as a result? Worse as a real result of...
I'd struggle to give you anything that's done better as a result of Brexit.
Not transportation, not...
Nothing.
Nothing. And if you were in the EU, it facilitates working throughout the all the European countries that are part of the EU. I'm not sure even how many are in there. I'm guessing... 20 plus
In states.
Yeah,
I think, was it 27 or is it now 27?
It's above 20.
Yeah, I know it's a few less than NATO. NATO's 32. So can you still work throughout the EU, or is it harder now?
It's a lot harder.
Okay.
All interactions with the EU have become more problematic for people who live in the UK, for UK citizens. So whereas before you didn't need to be stamped. And like when you entered the EU...
For your passport.
Exactly. Now you have to sort of stand in line with the rest of the world
Get
and get your stamps. So even simple things as going on holiday have gotten, you know, like the wait time in airports and things like that has got longer. And that's really at the low end of the issues.
Gotcha.
It's cool.
So if you want to jump on the channel, as I call it,
yeah,
you actually have to get a stamp to go into Paris or into...
Yeah, yeah, it all happened at the other end, I think.
Oh, wow.
I've never used it myself, so I don't actually know, but I believe it all happens at the other end.
Gotcha. So everything's harder.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could go back, you would rejoin the EU?
Absolutely. Yeah, without a second thought. And I get the feeling that there's a lot of people who might regret their decision in the vote as well. I definitely know a couple of people who voted to leave, and for justifiable reasons. I think that 'cause one of the issues with Brexit was there were always pros and cons to both decisions.
Okay.
And I think the pros to staying in outweighed the pros to leaving, and the cons for leaving outweighed the cons for staying, essentially.
So what was the big reason for leaving?
According to the establishment, it was to regain control of the country, of our borders, of our legal systems and this sort of thing, which was somewhat of a smokescreen because we had that. Oh. And it wasn't, I mean, there was this fallacy that the EU would basically come up with laws and then impose them on countries.
Okay.
But that's not the way it worked. So each directive that the EU came up with then had to be ratified in the local parliaments, basically.
Okay, so if the EU came up with a silly rule like no jaywalking, the English wouldn't automatically have to adopt that.
No, it has to be debated and passed into UK law, basically.
Okay, and Magda, is Poland part of the EU?
Yes, it is.
So, but do you have the, what was the currency even? Well, I was in Poland years ago.
Złota.
Yeah, I could never say this word. It started with a Z.
Yeah.
Do you still have the złota or is it?
Yes, we also kept our own currency.
Okay. And Poland, so I was there for Y2K, actually, right before the world was supposed to collapse at the year 2000 because of not enough numbers in the date. And it turned out it didn't collapse.
Luckily, we're still here.
And Poland at that time was up and coming, and you've said it's gotten rather expensive.
Yes. So Poland joined EU when I was a teenager. I don't remember what year it was, but I could just see with my own eyes rapid change and development. So Poland became like growing economy within mm-hmm. EU, thanks to the financial support. And I think what UK failed to do, just referring to Brexit, is to inform people how much they benefit from being in the European Union, which in Poland is a common knowledge. Any project that's supported by European money, that will be like advertised everywhere, saying how much of this new train line, for example, was funded by EU. In UK, you've never seen that. And I think that was the massive, massive mistake, that people were not aware how much they can be grateful for.
It's an excellent point as well, because overwhelmingly areas that had received large volumes of EU funding also overwhelmingly voted to leave. And they had, I think Magda's exactly
it's a paradox.
Right. They didn't realise
how much the EU was
how much support they were receiving from the EU.
Right. So even in Poland, you had the European trains built up as a result of joining the EU.
Yes, when Poland joined, it was one of the, obviously, by comparison to other countries that were already in EU, like France, Germany, relatively poor country, mm-hmm. because the EU has the special program of trying to bring all the countries to the same level. It will always give more money to the poorer countries.
So a lot of the Eastern European countries, former
exactly
communist bloc, Soviet bloc countries. And I remember even in 2000, Warsaw was up and coming. It was prices there were getting really expensive, but in the countryside, it was still a little bit, I want to say second world, like the train system wasn't even existing in some areas and you'd have to take the buses.
Yes. Yeah.
And I remember taking a bus, I think from Krakow to Zakopane. And I remember there wasn't even like a bathroom on the bus. It was like old school, like city bus, but it was going from city to city.
That's still probably the same.
In a small town.
Yeah. I think the toilet system in buses is still pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, the whole toilet thing is rather funny because I think I was in England, actually. And the train, when you went into the toilet and you lifted up the lid, you saw the tracks below.
Yes.
And there was a sign that said, do not use the bathroom at the train station, because everything would just fall out on the ground. Yeah. Is that still the situation, or have they put in proper toilets in the trains in England? Or
Yeah, they're proper toilets now. Yeah.
Okay.
You can flush when you're in a station.
Yeah, I always just wondered, like, I guess nobody would walk along the train tracks as kids. Or So Brexit, you say it's a negative thing. And as an American, I really have no clue about the issues. I just remember, the UK's kind of giving the middle finger to the EU, and we're going to see how that lands.
Yeah, it didn't land well. I think one of the most widespread issues is the new tariffs that are now imposed on trading.
Oh, really? Tariffs as well?
Yeah, because obviously by leaving the EU, you leave all of the trade agreements that the EU is part of. So the first port of call was to renegotiate a trade agreement with the EU. And
so now if you want to get your BMW or your Mercedes-Benz from Germany,
exactly.
There's going to be a tariff on it that wouldn't be there otherwise, maybe.
So import costs, export costs, the time it takes, the paperwork that needs to be filled out. I lost track of how many news articles there were about businesses struggling to keep up with the new regulations that they had to follow in order to continue trading with the EU. So something that before had required little to no paperwork and would take maybe a couple of days, depending on where you were sending it to, all of a sudden took, a portfolio of paperwork and up to a couple of weeks to sort out. Even just ordering something online from the EU, it went from being there, being with you in a few days to it might be a couple of weeks. We don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's a lot of inconveniences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we have a similar situation in the U.S. where it used to be if you ordered online, you wouldn't pay any sales tax. So if I ordered something from North Dakota, there'd be no sales tax coming to Arizona. And the Supreme Court here decided that no, everybody's going to pay sales tax to the state that it goes to. And that's made everything a little bit more expensive. But I could see a similar situation in Britain if you are having to pay tariffs and pay all these extra taxes.
Yeah, so prices went up for consumers. Initially, there were, food shortages of certain things on supermarket shelves because we imported so much food from the EU and that was getting slowed down. So you'd find that supermarkets might run out of a particular item and this sort of thing. It was when it first started, it was terrible. I mean, and that thing was, it only really started in 2021. So a lot of the issues that were resulting from these new tariffs and the new trade organization with the EU were blamed on COVID.
Right. That's what I was thinking of.
Because they'd negotiated a transition period as part of the trade deal. So the vote happened in 2016. Then there was the negotiation of the trade deal, which took a couple of years. And then you had a transition period, which was a few more years on top of that. So even after the vote and people said, people who'd voted to leave were celebrating, we've left the EU. Nothing actually changed for quite a few years after the votes.
Okay.
So people were sort of led into this false assumption that nothing had really changed and everything was okay. And then when things started to change, it was right on the back of COVID. And so they were blaming COVID for all of these issues.
So it's a double problem. You had the COVID issues plus the actual enactment of Brexit when everything started to come to a head. Interesting. How was COVID in England? Was it...
Interesting.
Was there big lockdowns and
several? Yeah. So I think the widespread consensus was the Johnson-led government were a bit wishy-washy,
okay,
and weren't quick enough to react. Because you could see the pandemic working its way across Europe, and
right.
I mean, I think Boris Johnson's first comment was, "Well, we could just let it go through." Basically,
until, but he kind of flip-flopped though, didn't he?
A little bit, until someone pointed out the political ramifications of just allowing, tens or hundreds of thousands of people to die on his watch. And then he decided to do something about it.
Okay.
Which was to lock down hard and fast.
It seems like England could have, you think of a zombie apocalypse, you're on an island, it seems like you could have just shut down and never been affected.
And other island nations like New Zealand, they
shut down hard.
They shut down hard and fast and they didn't suffer anywhere near as badly as other places.
And Magda, were you in Poland for COVID or where were you? Were you in the UK at the time?
Yes, I was in the UK.
Okay.
So I experienced the entire
The full UK COVID experience?
Yes, and I also worked in National Health Service at the time. So while many people could stop working, the health service actually couldn't stop working. I'm not a nurse, I did admin job, but still we're in full speed during this entire period of time. So seeing it from the inside was really quite terrifying, how much strain was put on the health service because of that decision, of Boris Johnson's decision.
Yeah, we saw a lot of that strain here too. We had nurses and doctors working way too long. And after it was all over, they were kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
They didn't get raises, they didn't get pay exactly. increases. And during it, everybody's like, you guys are heroes. But as soon as it was over, it's like, sorry, thanks for your help, but here's no extra money.
Yeah,
it was very similar in the UK. I know a lot of the rhetoric from the government was about not overwhelming the NHS.
Right.
And I mean, some of the coincidences that occurred, you know, like the Tory government had cut funding to the NHS and like cut 17,000 beds from their stock, and turned out that we needed 17,000 beds to cover all the COVID patients.
So in your, the Tories are the conservative, right?
Yes.
And the Labour is the, call it the liberal.
Yeah, left. Yeah.
And so the Tories are in power right now? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. And for a long time, it was Labour was...
So Labour had control between 97 and 2010. Following the financial crisis, they were voted out. And initially, we had a Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition for first Parliament from 2010 to 15. And then it was Conservative solely from 2015 till now.
So when we had our financial crisis, 2009, 2010, you guys also had... a financial crisis at the same time.
Yeah.
Worldwide, somewhat. Was it really bad? Like here, work just basically stopped in non-important sectors. Construction basically stopped. A lot of things stopped.
Yeah. I mean, working in commercial archaeology, we didn't see it straight away. There was a lag between the financial crash and the drying up of funding for construction work, because obviously we were already engaged in a lot of construction projects. But then the funding got cut. And so when those projects ran out, nothing new had started. And I mean, the archaeology industry suffered really badly.
I bet, yeah.
And a lot of companies folded. Pretty much every company had to downsize. I think it was pretty much the same across a lot of industries related to construction.
And so is England doing good now? Is the economy pretty strong?
No. A combination of factors, Brexit, COVID, the financial crisis. I mean, the economy's not as strong as it was pre-financial crisis. Wages aren't as good as they were pre-financial crisis.
The pound is not as strong against the dollar as it used to be.
No, it took several hits. So, I can't remember exact numbers, but we lost a lot of power against the dollar after the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And then Brexit, we lost another 10%. And then COVID hit. And then one of our sort of, I mean, she was really an interim prime minister. She lasted about a month. A lady called Liz Truss, she decimated the economy in her time there, and that lost another 10%. But I think we might have gained a bit of that back now. So, yeah, over the last sort of 15 years or so, the pound's suffered.
So we're running out of time. A couple of quick questions. You guys have been on the road for a year and a half. How do you fund this? Do you work along the way, or independently wealthy, trust fund, like...
Inheritance. Savings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same with me.
Yeah. So just, and then you'll go back to work eventually.
Yeah.
Back and where are you going? You're in Flagstaff, Arizona now. Where are you heading next? You had mentioned a train ride across the US, which I said is insane. And I think other people have said so too.
Yeah. We're going coast to coast. So we're using trains all the way. So from here, it's off to San Francisco. Then we break the train in Salt Lake City and head up to Yellowstone, and then back to Salt Lake City to get back on the Zephyr and go to Chicago. We stay there for about a week, and then we go to Niagara for a couple of days, and then we end in New York.
And then fly back to the UK and then off to Poland. Exciting. We'll see. I'm curious to see how your train trip goes. 'Cause I've been on the trains in America and on the trains in Europe, and Europe is a much better train system. And that's an understatement. But I'm sure you'll have a good time and you'll see a lot of beautiful things. Tom and Magda, thank you for coming on the radio today, and I wish you good travels.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
you're listening to the podcast, please give us a great review and also give us a comment in there. If you're not listening to the podcast, subscribe. Look up the Jeff Horvitz Show. Also on video, Rumble, follow us there. And on YouTube, subscribe. We appreciate everyone who's done that.
This is the Jeff Horvitz Show.